Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
This is the Parsha Balak, which refers to Balak, king of Moab, an ancient state in southern Jordan. After sweeping victories which God gave to the children of Israel against the nations which took up the sword against her, the Parsha states that the inhabitants of Moab were seized with fear and the dread of Israel. So King Balak of Moab sent for a sorcerer named Balaam, son of Beor, to come and curse Israel. What follows from this is a miraculous chain of events which sees God turn the curse into a blessing, including the blessed prophetic utterances of the coming of Lord Yeshua. Now, before we actually talk about that story in the Parsha, I just want to give a small archaeological insight. Has anybody heard of the Dayar Allah inscription? Nevertheless, it was uncovered only a few years ago in an ancient temple in Jordan, in what is Ammon and Moab, sort of on the border there. And when archaeologists are trying to decipher, they're piecing together a very ancient form of script that was relatively unknown, and it's part Canaanite and part Aramaic script. Now, Aramaic and Hebrew is identical in as a written language. Words are pronounced a little bit differently, and Canaanite is very similar as well because it is a semi-Semitic tongue, although they are a Hamitic people. But this showed how ancient this inscription in this temple was. Now, when pieced together, the inscription was deciphered to be the visions of a sorcerer named Balaam, son of Beor. Is it the same Balaam, son of Beor? Well, according to the translations, this is what the oracle says on the wall of the temple. The quest of kings and seers comes to nothing. The quest of the king is nothing but moth rot, and the quest of his seers. Your quest is distant from you to know how to deliver an oracle to his people, but you have been condemned for your speech and forbidden from pronouncing the words of cursing. It's very, very interesting. As we're going to find out in the Parsha, that's exactly what happened. All scholars and academics, whether secular or religious, on both sides of the archaeological divide, all agree that this Balaam, son of Beor, that is whose oracle is written on the side of this temple, is most certainly the same Balaam, son of Beor, that is mentioned in this week's Parsha from the book of Numbers. Obviously, he was a pretty well-known fellow back then. A sorcerer, could speak to jinns, could speak to demonic forces, had some understanding of divinity. They would actually call him into wars to pronounce specific curses against nations so that kings could defeat those nations. And this is what happened. This king of Jordan, or Moab, called him to do it. And Balaam was going to, but God intervened in a dream and said, "You shall not curse the people because they are blessed." So Balaam says he's not going to go with the king. We read on, however, that the king Balak will honor whatever Balaam has to prophesy. Balaam goes up to meet King Balak. Now, on his way, an angel with a drawn sword, who in Jewish tradition is Gabriel, attempts to prevent Balaam, or Balaam, as people call him. And three times Balaam's ass, or donkey, that he's riding, honors the angel and steers away from the road. You know this story. I'll go through it even if you do, because it's very interesting, and I've always found this part of the Parsha very funny. Balaam gets quite irate with the donkey, or his ass, and he beats it and beats it and beats it until the donkey actually opens up its mouth and speaks to him and says, "You've known me for all this time. Have I ever been in the manner of doing this to you before?" And Balaam says, "No." It's very striking that Balaam doesn't question why his donkey decides to say, "Hey, Shrek, man, why you hit me with that stick for?" You know, he doesn't even question it. He talks back to the donkey and says, "No, you haven't done this to me before." All of a sudden, it says that the angel opens up Balaam's eyes, and Balaam sees the angel standing on the road with a drawn sword, okay, or drawn weapon in Hebrew. Obviously, gets off the ass and he bows his head down and realizes he's having a divine encounter. Now, this angel, unlike others, is pretty merciful. And that's why it's believed to be Gabriel, although not stated by name. We'll look at that in a moment. But the angel says, look, I'll turn around, I'll go back if you want me to. And the angel says, you know, I would have taken your life while sparing the donkey, had the donkey had not steered away from you, from me three times and sat down underneath you. The donkey would have been spared, but you would not have. Come, but only do what you are told. Only repeat what God tells you to do. And Balaam accepts this, gets back on the poor old donkey and rides off. Now he goes and meets King Balak, and he instructs the king Balak to build 7 altars to offer sacrifices to God, and begins to prophesy every blessing and praise over Israel. Now, thinking that this will somehow make a difference, King Balak takes him 3 times on the same mountain to a different area, sort of, you know, north, south, and east. Maybe if he stood in another direction, God would allow him to curse Israel. I mean, this is the thinking. And each time, of course, Balaam doesn't. He only says what God tells him to say, and he blesses the people. Some of those blessings are, look, Numbers 24, verse 5. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, and your dwelling places, O Israel. God who has brought them out of Egypt with the strength of his loftiness, he shall consume the nations which are his adversaries. Those who bless you shall be blessed, and those who curse you shall be cursed. This type of thing goes on each time, each 3 times. Now, needless to say, King Balak is pretty dismal over the affair. He's asked this prophetic seer to come up and curse the people, and instead he's blessed them 3 times. He said, I'm not going to pay you. Go on your way. At this, Balaam offers yet one more prophecy. And this is in 24 verse 17. And it's concerning the messianic redemption. And he says, I see it, but not now. I behold it, but not soon. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter will arise from Israel, which will crush the princes of Moab and uproot all the sons of Seth. He then also prophesies the future destruction of the Assyrian Empire, Amalek, and Edom. It's very interesting. God gets the last say, and a pagan believer, and not just a pagan, someone, a sorcerer, someone who was into dealing with divinities, did acknowledge God Most High. The God Most High is not a stranger to the ancient people. We've gone through this many times. You'll find him in ancient Egypt. You most certainly find him in Babylon and many of the ancient civilizations. There is this ultimate creator God above them all. And Balaam knew this. And Balaam honored this at this point. We're told, though, in a few weeks that Israel was led astray into a cult with Midianite women, a sexual cult, some of which involved some pretty horrific things such as necrophilia. And we're told that it is Balaam who gave the advice on how to entrap Israel with these women. So he might have honored God in this parsha, and only blessed the people who God had blessed and not cursed. But at the same time, he said, well, I'm not going to curse the people because God's blessed them. But he's used a political trick and thinks, well, I could get God to curse them instead. Therefore, do this. This will entice them into the sin, and then God himself will be against them. This was Balaam's thinking. He's eventually killed for it, and no mercy is to be shown. Even though in this parsha, Balaam stood on the mountain 3 times and blessed the people of Israel, that didn't spare him. Because when his depraved mind later on decided to try and work God politically, okay, which had disastrous effects upon the nation of Israel right up until the time of beyond Joshua and into the book of Judges. There was a plague upon the people, which sounds very much, we'll go into that another time, but very much like a sexually transmitted disease, like a gonorrhea or a syphilis, because that's what it was all about. And it says we're still suffering this in our loins to this day. Something pretty heavy happened. It had a disastrous effect, but Balaam was eventually killed because of what he did. Okay, so we can't call him a hero. We can say he shows the power of God. I mean, this is what we have to look at. He demonstrates the power of God, that he blessed the people instead of cursing them, and that he did acknowledge God Most High, but that didn't make him righteous either, because he was very quick to turn aside and consider that he could even change God's mind by causing his people to sin, sort of find a loophole in the law type of thing, which is what he did.
And he had the others muttering against him, which probably meant that he thought he would be killed by them for having blessed instead of cursed.
Yeah, probably.
Either way, he was going to get it.
Probably. And that's why I find it.
He didn't want to take that chance.
Absolutely. But that's why I find the inscription so interesting as well. Because he says in that inscription that's been found in Jordan, the quest of the king comes to nothing. it is forbidden to pronounce the words of cursing, etc. That could have been very well the last oracle, written oracle, that Balaam ever made. Because we're told that within just a few weeks of this, he's put to the sword for trying to do something else. So it's quite amazing. It's not that we need archaeological proof, but it's wonderful when we do find it. And it gives us a deeper insight, a more of an understanding. So all we know of Balaam is what we have read in the scripture, but then to see a temple with his oracles written on them, it tells us a lot about him, the character, etc. It just gives us that little bit more of more colour to the picture. And I personally find that quite amazing. Now, as I mentioned, the angel on the road was believed in tradition, traditionally, to be Gabriel, because this angel was merciful. It didn't attack. It stood with a drawn sword and it spoke. Okay? And each time there are other angels that just take out the sword and start destroying until God has to sort of grab them around the throat and put them in check. They're just created to do that. They have God's name inside them. They burn with that fire. Others, you know, are merciful as well, but it's usually a pretty scary experience to come in direct contact with these angelic beings, and you're always armed to the teeth. I mean, you find this all throughout Scripture. However, with Gabriel, it's a little bit different. In Daniel chapter 9, verse 1 to 27, you have this meeting between Daniel and Gabriel, and it's quite beautiful. This is, I think, the fluffy feeling, the fluffy ideology we have of angels, I think really comes from Gabriel. You know, there are times throughout Scripture where, as I said, angels can be quite fierce and can be quite frightening, and they don't lay their hand on the people, but the people are usually kind of shrieking and, you know, ooh, this is a scary episode. Any divine episode can be that way for people, but Gabriel is almost quite loving to Daniel. And if you just want to make a note of that, Daniel chapter 9, verse 1 to 27, and then you have the meeting between the angel Gabriel and Miriam, which is in Luke chapter 1, verse 26 to 38. Just cross-reference both of those scriptures for yourself, and you start to get something of a personality of Gabriel. Same personality, okay? There's a reason I'm bringing this up. We're going to detract just a little bit from the parsha. We do that sometimes. I'll see something that reminds me of something else in Scripture, and I mean, all word is intermittent anyway. We've talked about Balaam, we've talked about what he's done, we've summed up the Parsha itself, but there are a couple of things here of curiosity to me, and made me think of other issues, specifically this week. Keep Gabriel in mind, please, and what I've just said about Gabriel's character, and cross-reference those two scriptures for yourself. I think about Balaam on the mountain where the curse was turned into a blessing three times. I think about that testing, how Balak, the king of Moab, tested him. I also think about Yeshua as well on the mountain when he was driven out into the wilderness and he was tested by the devil three times, we're told. And we'll find that in Matthew chapter 4, verse 1 to 11. Everyone knows the story. Do we have to go there in Scripture? He was driven out not long after his immersion. Hasatan, or the adversary, comes to him three times. If you're the Son of God, you know, command these stones to turn to bread and feed yourself. Okay? Yeshua stands against him. Satan can quote Scripture. Remember that. Satan can quote Scripture. Okay? We have the last episode as well. Oh, sorry. If you're the Son of God, throw yourself off the mountain. Surely it says that angels will, you know, will rescue you unless you hurt your foot on a stone. Yeshua rebukes him again. And then the third time, Satan offers him all the kingdoms of the earth and says, they're mine. If you will but worship me, I'll give you all the kingdoms on earth. Mm-hmm. And Yeshua finally says, love the Lord your God and serve only him. Get away from me, Satan. And Satan leaves him. And I find it interesting, not saying that they're connected, but it comes to mind when I think of Balak taking Balaam to three different areas of that mountain. Maybe you can do it from here. Maybe we'll do it from here. Maybe you can curse him from here. I think of Satan taking Yeshua all around the mountain too, saying, do this over here. No, okay, we'll try it over here. Do it over here and do it over here. It just springs to mind for me. And there's another man in history named Muhammad, a son of the Ishmaelites, of the Arabian tribes. And according to Islam, Muhammad was also taken up the mountain by an angel called Jibril, and in Islam that is supposedly synonymous with the angel Gabriel. And Muhammad was also shown all the kingdoms of the earth and promised them if he would submit to Allah and become the apostle or messenger. Of course, he does. And afterwards, the Islamic Empire begins. Keep in mind again that we've spoken about the basic nature of Gabriel. Gabriel is the one that is sent to Miriam or Mary, and he's merciful and loving, or it is loving, merciful, kind, pacifies her, makes her feel comfortable, is the bearer of the gospel in a sense, because he's coming to bear the good news that she is going to give birth to the Son of God. Gabriel's a very intimate messenger, very intimate messenger. Again, Daniel, who is a castrated servant in Nebuchadnezzar's palace, is fasting and praying and weeping on behalf of the sins of his people because he knows they're in captivity because of all that they've done. And it's Gabriel that comes to him and speaks kindly to him and recognizes him as a servant of God. God seems to send Gabriel on, how would you put it? Again, I'll use that word intimate, but sensitive issues.
Mercy missions.
Yeah. Gabriel's there for the mercy missions. This is the character. But according to Islam, and comparative religion's not a bad thing, and we have to do comparative religion when it comes to Islam because they claim to be a monotheistic religion belonging to the faith of Abraham. They say that their God is the God of Abraham, their God is the God of Moses, their God is the God of Jesus, etc. So we have to discuss this because it is of interest. According to the Hadith, which you have the Quran, which is the main words of Islamic scripture, then you have the Sunnah, which are the examples, what's called the examples of the Prophet, and the words Sunni, as in Sunni and Shia, come from the Sunnah, those who follow the example of the Prophet. Then you have the Hadith, and the Hadith is written by the companions of the Prophet that saw things that he did and wrote basically the essentials of Islamic history and tell us all about Muhammad, because there's not a lot in the Quran about him and his actual life. You have the recitations of the Quran, okay, the words given through Jibril, the angel, but you don't have a lot about the history, so the Hadith tells you all about that. Now, in the Sahih Bukhari Hadith, this is what it says about Muhammad's first calling, when he was first called with this angel, Jibril. And again, I use that term. It's meant to be Gabriel. I'll let you make that up for yourself. Keep in mind Gabriel's character when I read this out. This is Volume 1, Book 1, Number 3. The Prophet Muhammad added, "The angel caught me forcefully and pressed me so hard that I could not bear the pain anymore. It then released me and again asked me to read, and I replied, 'I do not know how to read.' Thereupon it caught me again and pressed me a second time, burning me till I could bear it no more. It then released me and again asked me to read, but again I replied, 'I do not know how to read.' Thereupon it caught me for the third time and pressed against me and burnt me, then released me and said, 'Read in the name of Allah who has created man from a clot of blood. Read and your Lord will be generous.' Then Allah's apostle returned with the inspiration and with his heart beating severely within him. And he went to Hajjah and said, 'Cover me, cover me.' They covered him till his fear was over. And after that, told her everything that had happened and said, 'I feel that something has happened to me.' Dreaded. Hajjah replied, 'Never, by Allah, never. Allah shall not disgrace you.' But after a few days, divine inspiration was paused for a while. And the Prophet Muhammad became so sad, as we have heard, that he intended several times to throw himself from the tops of the high mountains. And every time he went up the mountain to throw himself off, Jibril would appear and say, 'Muhammad, you are indeed Allah's apostle.' Whereupon his heart would become quiet and he would calm down and return home. Whenever the period of the coming of this inspiration from Jibril was long, he would do as before, go to the top of the mountain to commit suicide, but Jibril would appear before him and say to him what he had said before." That encounter with Gabriel is in direct conflict with scriptural evidence on Gabriel. In fact, it's pretty scary. It's very, very scary. We are told in this week's Haftarah of the prophet Micah that the message of the Torah and the prophets, and most certainly the character of that message that was demonstrated through Abraham, through Moses, through Elijah, and most certainly embodied in Lord Yeshua and his disciples, was this. And this is an answer to Israel's longing on how to serve God. Micah 6 verse 8. He has told you, O man, what is good and what God demands of you, but to do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God. On that, the law, the prophets, the writings, and the gospel all agree. To do justice, protect the poor, the fatherless, the widow, the orphan, the stranger, believer or non-believer alike. To do what is good, to love kindness, mercy, charity, to make peace, to make people's spirits sensitive and peace and peaceful, and to walk humbly before God. But according to Muhammad, the message that sums up the entire scripture is this, Quran 8 verse 12. I shall terrorize the infidels, so wound their bodies and incapacitate them because they oppose Allah and his apostle. Paradise lies under the shade of swords. You are commanded to carry out jihad against the unbelieving infidel until they submit to Islam. And slay them wherever you find them and drive them out of the places where they drove you out. For the persecution and disbelief of Muslims is worse than the slaughter of non-believers. And fight them until persecution is no more and religion belongs only to Allah. Then fight in the cause of Allah and know that Allah hears and knows all things. They but wish you should reject faith as they do and thus be on the same footing, but take no friends from their ranks until they flee in the way. And if they turn renegade, seize them and slay them wherever you find them. In any case, take no friend or whatever helper from amongst their ranks. And fight with them until there's no more persecution and religion should only be for Allah. And Allah's apostle has proclaimed, I have been made victorious with terror. And again, killing unbelievers is but a small matter to us. I have every single one of those quotes if anyone would like to see me afterwards. They're from the Quran, the Sunnah, and the Hadith. There are at this time this week children being buried in Israel. And many Christians have been slaughtered in Iraq this week also. I find it horrifying that in the West it's not known as greatly because these Christians are either of different Christian traditions or because they come from a country they couldn't care less about. But the Assyrian and Chaldean Christian communities are some of the most ancient Christian communities on this earth. And they were from an ancient people that had a conflict with God. And the messianic prophetic fulfillments of the Messiah and his job to reconcile human beings with God, and that we even heard from the word of Balaam, the mouth of Balaam in this week's Parsha, have come to fruition amongst these people. God made peace with those that even burned his temple to the ground and their descendants. But right now, they're being wiped out and being driven from their lands at the moment by a group calling itself ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. They're claiming to be creating a new caliphate. We can talk about the history of Islam at another time if you want. It's the one thing I did major in, surprisingly better than all others. It's a strange coincidence. But the jihadist doctrine is popular amongst these Muslims because, as we've noted, its founder founded the religion on the jihadist doctrine. There's no two ways about it. There's no nice way of saying this. It doesn't mean all Muslims, but it is most certainly Islam. I have found it appalling that in the West, including among Christian communities such as the Presbyterian Church, there is sympathy with these monsters. And other peace-loving Europeans have chosen the suicidal ideology called appeasement with them. To this end, it's time to speak the truth and to be fearless of speaking that truth, lest you come under the condemnation of political sensitivity or political correctness. In the mind of the jihadists, and we're talking about the jihadists here, in the minds of jihadists, the Christians, the Jews, and the non-believer are all destined to be either one, converted by force, two, put under a tax that is heavier than anybody else's until you are subjugated, broken, and forced to convert to Islam, or three, put to death. That's one, two, and three. You're converted by force, you pay a tax until you can't pay anymore and you have to convert to Islam, or you're put to the sword for rejecting Allah and his messenger, Muhammad. They're the three major pillars of Islamic conquest, of Muslims dealing with non-Muslims. Now, there are many, there's over a billion Muslims out there on this earth, and not all of them follow this. That's to be sure. There are millions, hundreds of millions of Muslims who mind their own business in Indonesia, all throughout the Middle East and North Africa. They're just people. They're just people, and that's the religious tradition and customs their families follow. Most of them following it, specifically if they're black, or if they're Iranian, or if they're Pakistani, or if they're Indonesian or otherwise, not because they thought Islam was a beautiful religion, and there are some who converted out of desire to join it, but the beginnings, and this is history, Islam was spread because they were forced into it with the sword, they had a tax put on their backs and necks, including the Lebanese and the Palestinian Arabs and all the rest of them, or had their heads chopped off. That's how Islam spread to begin with. That is history. That is Islamic history. They're proud of it. Now, as I said, those people today that are what we would call moderate Muslims, they're not our enemy. But keep in mind that the religion, as it is, the religion, if it is practiced down to the T, is what is being practiced by the jihadists. If we say the religion started with Muhammad and we take his example, and then we look at the jihadists and look at their example, it is the same example. There is no such thing as moderate Islam historically, but you do today have moderate Muslims, and thank God we have them. But look, Muhammad accepted there was a God Most High. So did Balaam. But the message of Allah and his apostle is not the gospel that we can ever accept. So as long as there are the jihadi elements in this world, and they're more powerful, the silent majority are a silent majority because they can't do anything against the 30 to 40% jihadist mentality, which again looks to convert and rule under those three guidelines.
When you put it in figures, it's over 300 million.
Of course.
Which is the population million. Of the United States of America.
Exactly.
Spread out throughout the world.
Exactly. We will always be, and the rest of the world will always be at loggerheads over those three elements, and specifically us as believers. We look to Galatians verse 1, 6 to 9. We are clearly informed. If we could look, I can bring up historically from the Quran, from the Sunnah, from the Hadith, so many instances to demonstrate the difference between the biblical faith and the Islamic faith. And we can go through that as much as you like. But I'm going to tell you, he's preaching a different gospel. And in Galatians 1, verse 6 to 9, please look it up. It's pretty black and white and pretty simple. Galatians 1, verse 6 to 9. Keeping in mind, Muhammad is calling from a Jibril or Gabriel that bears no resemblance to the angel Gabriel. What he was offered up on the mountain and what Christ was offered upon the mountain, and the message that he had, and how to spread that message. I am astonished that you are so quickly deserting the one who called you to live in the grace of Christ and turn to a different gospel, which is really no gospel at all. Evidently, some people are throwing you into confusion and trying to pervert the gospel of Messiah. But even if we or an angel from heaven should preach a gospel other than the one we have preached to you, let them be under God's curse. As we have already said, so now I say it again. If anybody is preaching to you a gospel other than what you accepted, let them be under God's curse. Where does Muhammad stand in view of that scripture? Do I have to answer the question? Shabbat shalom.
Yeah.
Meeting is making a way.